This episode contains adult themes and is not appropriate for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, the world. This is They Will Kill, a true crime podcast. I'm Sadie Eck.
And I am Courtney Eck.
Did you hear those little birds right before I said hello? Choo. They're saying hi, too.
Yeah, I got finches. This place is lousy with finches.
It's Courtney's night.
It is. We're not here to talk about birds. This is not an apiary podcast. Oh, that's probably not accurate way to use that word at all, but it is not that. It is a true crime podcast, and tonight we are talking about the murders of Kay and Bob Schwartz. So Bob and Kay Schwartz met at the University of Maryland just outside of D.C. as they were both pursuing their master's degrees in education. There was a bit of an age difference, and Bob was 35 and Kay was 27, and both had aspirations to become teachers. They had a short courtship and were married 18 months after they met. They were deeply religious people who were heavily involved in their local church, and everyone knew who they were. They were such a prominent part of their religious community. Bob ended up working in engineering at NASA Goddard in the space program.
Wow.
I know.
Look at him.
And was smart enough to have a working understanding of computers in the early 80s when they were still in their infancy. Well, as far as like us, right. The general public. People said that Bob was a very positive person who was quick to laugh and had a great sense of humor. Similarly, Kay had a fun-loving, carefree spirit, and everyone who met her loved her. She completed her teacher's training and became a teacher after completing her master's. Her love for children extended to their home life as well, but the couple were devastated to learn that Kay couldn't conceive children of her own. Being the upbeat and positive people that they were, they soon decided to pursue adoption, and so in 1973, they met Larry Schwartz, who was 6 years old at the time and had been bounced around between foster families throughout his young life. Bob and Kay specifically wanted to care for children who had had a rough childhood and give them the loving stability they needed to thrive moving forward. Larry had been subjected to physical abuse at his previous homes, and it was reported that he sometimes exhibited unhealthy behavior, like eating out of garbage cans and repeatedly checking on his foster family to make sure they were still there.
Stop.
Yeah. He was also diagnosed with learning disabilities.
Oh, buddy.
6 years after that, they adopted a 4-year-old girl named Annie, who had been born in Korea and didn't speak much English when she entered their home. The four of them were a loving family, and Bob and Kay were thrilled to have the opportunity to be parents. So in 1984, Bob and Kay lived with their two adopted children in Cape St. Clair, Maryland. At the time, in 1984, Annie was 9 and Larry was 17. So on a snowy morning in 1984, Larry woke up and Annie told him she couldn't find their parents. Larry searched around and then looked out their dining room window where he spotted his mother's body face down in the yard.
Oh, no.
He said he shielded Annie from seeing their mother and then called the police to inform them that something horrible had happened. Officers found Kay Schwartz face down in the snow just outside of the sliding glass door that led inside, and she was only wearing one sock on her right foot. I think she was nude. Mm-hmm. I read that she was also nude. She had many puncture wounds around her neck, a massive wound on the top of her head, and was surrounded by a pool of her own blood. Police searched the house and found a black vinyl chair in the basement that had a pool of blood around it. And when I say the basement, I think that this is sort of a split level home in my mind where like the family room is downstairs. So it's right. Not, you know, like basement, but it's like basement. A living area. Yeah. That pool of blood led out of the house and to the spot where they found Kay's body. So they assumed she had been attacked while sitting in that chair and then had fled into the backyard where she succumbed to her injuries. Mm. Detectives then searched a small office, and when they opened the door, they found Bob Schwartz dead inside. He had been clearly stabbed many times. defensive wounds were present, and it seemed likely that Kay had been attacked first, and then Bob was attacked when he started to leave the room to see what was going on.
Oh, yeah.
There were no signs of forced entry, so police wondered if their attacker knew them or had maybe snuck in through an unlocked door. The crime scene was, quote, extraordinarily gruesome, and so it seemed like a targeted attack. There was no sign of a murder weapon, but detectives collected as much evidence as they could, and they had a big break when they found a bloody palm print on the sliding glass door that led to Kay's body. Bob's hands were bloody, but he'd clearly died in the office where he had been attacked and had not left that room.
Mm-hmm.
Kay had traveled through the sliding door, but her hands were completely clean of blood, so it was very likely that the palm print belonged to the killer.
Mm-hmm.
Detectives fanned out and searched the area around the home and noticed a bloody trail leading into the woods near the house. They followed the trail, and eerily, there were footprints along the trail, and one of the feet appeared to be bare, while the other appeared to be wearing a sock, indicating that Kay might have been the one to make the trail.
Wow.
That was especially odd considering her body had been found just outside of the door to the home. There was also a set of footprints that had been wearing shoes, so it seemed that there had been a chase through the woods and into the neighborhood. Police guessed that the killer had attacked Kay, then turned on Bob as he emerged from the office, and then went back to Kay, who was trying to flee.
But she, like, fled through the neighborhood?
Yes.
And then came back.
They speculated that the killer was able to catch up with her and then walked her back to the house where she was attacked again and killed.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Courtney.
As they searched the woods, they got another break when they found a wooden splitting maul, like an axe. They kept calling it a maul. An axe that had signs of blood and hair on it. It's fucking axe shit, man. Like, just don't.
Worst.
The handle had been wiped clean and there was no blood or other evidence visible on the handle. The axe was sent to the lab for testing, and there was no sign of the knife that had also been used to murder the Schwartzes. So detectives questioned the children, and Annie said that she had been awakened in the middle of the night by her father screaming for help. She said she looked out of the glass door that led into their carport and saw a man walking away from the house with an axe over his shoulder. She said the man was very tall and had curly hair. Police then spoke to Larry, who seemed a little nervous, and he said that, quote, Michael was 6'4". Police were like, who the heck is Michael?
Yeah, I want to know.
And Larry explained that he actually had a 17-year-old brother who no longer lived with the family after he started getting into a lot of trouble.
I don't like it.
Police spoke to other family members who quickly confirmed that Michael would be a very good place to start as they sorted through potential suspects, as they'd heard that Michael had made threats to his family in their home.
So Larry, this is not just Larry's, like, biological brother. This is another adopted brother.
Exactly right.
Michael.
So,
okay.
Yep. After the Schwartzes adopted Larry and before they adopted Annie, they adopted 8-year-old Michael to give Larry a brother. And much like Larry, Michael had had a very rough life before meeting the Schwartz family. Larry and Michael were only 6 months apart in age, too. Michael had been abandoned by his mother as an infant, had been living in foster care ever since, and had lived in a total of 6 foster homes in his young life. As hard as the Schwartzes tried to help turn Michael's life around, the troubled boy was so antisocial by the time they adopted him, the trouble started almost immediately. Michael was generally very combative, liked to fight back when his parents asked him to do things he didn't want to do, and was known to use offensive language. Bob and Kay continued to try to help Michael succeed and put a fair amount of pressure on both boys. Larry was more soft-spoken, he was shy and eager to please, so he tended to do what his parents asked of him and had a better time getting along in the home. 2 years after Michael was adopted, Annie was brought into the home, and she was the apple of Bob's eye. It was clear to everyone that knew the family that sweet, adorable Annie was the favorite child. Everyone was like, she was the favorite. It was not a secret.
Ugh.
and having the new addition seemed to amplify tension between the Schwartzes and their boys.
Wow. I mean, that's just so much.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not blaming, but it's just like, that's a lot.
This is a complicated case because, it's
adoption is complicated. And
well, we'll get more into that. Yeah. And this is why I chose this case. But yeah, Sadie and I worked at a group home. We've talked about this before, but we put ourselves through college working at a group home. And we had one boy who's the darlingest, sweetest, dearest boy, but he had engaged in some very inappropriate behavior with his siblings, and he was adopted. He and his brother, biological brother, were adopted by this family. And I think they had 14 or 15 mm-hmm. children living in the home total.
Yeah.
And I just had a really hard time with that because had this boy not had, you know, he had some, I think, one-on-one attention, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
He could have had a better chance of succeeding in that home, but right. It's hard, you know, it's hard. Like, these are well-intentioned people. And that boy's parents obviously wanted to help as many children as they could. But then at what cost, you know, it's
right.
just, it's well, very
it help at that point.
Precisely. Yep. Yeah. So, yeah, you have two, you know, troubled boys who had very hard lives. And then you bring in a third and then you just clearly favor the third. And it's hard.
No, not with severe abandonment issue. I mean, not in general, but especially for kids that need attachment more than anything.
Exactly. So Larry was easygoing enough that he skated by for the most part, but Michael continued to be outspoken and argumentative, especially as his parents showered love and affection on young Annie. So by 1980, 5 years after being adopted, Michael's behavior had escalated to the point where Bob and Kay were at their wits' end and didn't know what to do with him anymore. One night in particular, Michael asked if he could go out with his friends, and his parents said no, and so he decided to sneak out of the house. He got home around midnight and pounded on the front door to be let in, but Kay refused to unlock the door and let him in. Michael spent the night in a neighbor's house and got himself to school the next morning, but the incident was the last straw for the Schwartzes, who called social services and said they could no longer control their son. They said that they were so fed up with his behavior that they wanted him to be placed in a new family and he never returned to the Schwartz home again.
Oh, Courtney, this is too complicated. I feel for everybody.
Yes, it's a very complicated story. That is very hard.
Yes, that is so traumatizing.
Hard. Yeah, yep.
Oh, I don't like it.
I don't either. 5 years. He's 17 at this point.
Yes. Yep. Oh, man.
So after he was kicked out of the house, Michael's mental health seemed to go downhill. Fucking, of course right. It did. He was sent to a reform school where he acted out so severely, he was sent to a mental hospital for evaluation. No. And this was just a couple of weeks before Bob and Kay were murdered.
Oy.
Police went to interrogate Michael, who was still in the mental hospital when they were murdered, and he denied having anything to do with the murders, but did have noticeable marks on his neck, which he claimed were hickeys.
Oh my God.
Michael was adamant that he had been at the hospital on the night of the murders, and the facility's records reflected that that was true.
Okay.
There isn't a much better alibi than having been in a locked ward in a state mental hospital.
Right.
But people were still skeptical and wondered if there was a way that Michael could have sneaked out, considering it was a hospital and not a prison. Regardless, police didn't have enough evidence to arrest him, and soon after, Michael got a lawyer and refused to answer any more questions. So the only chance police had to narrow down their killer was the bloody handprint on the sliding door, but forensics were limited in 1984, and so they had to send the evidence to the FBI lab and hope for a break. In the meantime, the coroner's report came back and showed that Bob had been stabbed 17 times, and both of his right and left carotid arteries had been severed.
Youch.
Yep. Kay had been stabbed tentatively 7 times around her neck. And her skull was later split with the axe. Yeah. Police also started to get a more clear picture of what life had been like in the Schwartz home. And one incident that was relayed to detectives was a time when Michael had gotten in trouble for fighting on the school bus or something similar. And Bob had decided that manual labor would be a suitable punishment.
Man.
I know. Bob gave Michael a wood-splitting maul, like the one that had been used to kill Kay, and told him that he had to remove a massive tree stump in their front yard.
Oh, no.
So Michael spent upwards of 3 hours a day after school for a month chipping away at the enormous stump. There's video footage. A neighbor took video of it. I'm assuming the neighbor was like, what the fuck are they doing to that kid? You know, he's been out there every single day. Yeah, there's actual video footage of it. So at the end of the month, the stump wasn't much smaller and Michael's hands were covered with blisters. And at that point, he threatened that he wanted to kill his parents.
Well, I mean, it's hard not to be like put myself in his shoes.
Yes.
And I am very conflicted by this. But I know the rage that I felt as a teen, and I was like a very easygoing person with a stable upbringing.
Yeah.
And if my parents had made me go axe down a tree stump, you know, like I just, I feel it. I can imagine the rage inside of that child.
Yeah. And every day this just like repetitive, pointless, you know, it just feels so unfair. It feels so, unfair, you know, it just doesn't, it's not helping you in any way. It's not teaching you something. It just feels like you're being like humiliated. And, and it's like, you know, in the 80s and 90s, parents were very into experimental punishments. Mm-hmm. All of my friends' parents did weird shit to punish them and would do these like unending groundings and things and just these like really extreme measures for, you know, things that were just kids being kids. And, you know, no wonder we all have fucking serious issues.
Like total terrible resentment.
And, So I know that Bob was not alone in thinking, oh, well, if I have my kid do this stupidly awful, you know, punishment for a really long time, like other people were doing
this
it too.
This is going to teach him whatever.
So, so he threatened that he wanted to kill his parents. Michael said to Kay at one point that he could stab his father in the back and kill him and get away with it because he was underage. Police, of course, also wondered if the maul that Michael had used to hack up the stump could have been the same one that was used to kill his mother, Kay. So Michael was allowed to attend the Schwartz's funeral, and he still had visible red marks on his neck, and rumors about his involvement in the murders spread throughout the community to the point that the local newspapers were reporting that he was a suspect. Hey everyone, we are proud to announce that this podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, with a P, not health, help. As you all know, our lives, Sadie and my life, has been completely nuts for the last couple of years, and even more so in the last couple of weeks. And it's very important that we show up for ourselves throughout it all. We've always made that a priority in our lives and sharing that information with you all. So BetterHelp is online therapy, which will assess your needs and can match you with your own licensed professional therapist in less than 48 hours.
That's crazy.
I know, Sadie. How's your brain been these days?
Oh, boy, you guys. I mean, you know, my brain has been on the fritz.
On fire. Sadie's brain is
literally on fire. Therapy can sure help with that.
Yeah.
And in fact, I have an appointment on Friday to see my therapist.
Which I'm very jealous of, because you know what's really, really hard in 2022?
Finding a therapist.
Yes.
To help
you. Yep. BetterHelp can help you with that. It is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional therapy done securely online, available to people worldwide.
Worldwide?
Yeah. Australia. Are you listening? You guys have the worst cases. You need
help.
Support.
Help.
With therapy, it can take a few tries to find the right fit for you. But guess what? BetterHelp makes it easy and free to change therapists if needed.
In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states.
Yeah! Go therapy. Go put your brains out. Put them out. The fire's not your brains. Keep them in. So they have a special offer for our listeners. Get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/theywill.
That's
just it. Just they will.
Yeah, 10% off your first month of online therapy at betterhelp.com/theywill. Do it, you guys. Seriously, you won't regret it.
Put your brains out of fire.
Don't let your brains be on fire.
Put your brains out of fire. Put your brains out of fire. Today. So detectives decided to visit the mental hospital that Michael was staying in to determine how realistic it would have been for him to escape and kill his parents and then return undetected. So they asked to be locked into the ward that Michael was living in, and after investigating every door and window, they were convinced that there was no possible way Michael could have sneaked out without assistance, and so he was finally ruled out as a suspect.
Really?
Yep. So then who the heck killed Bob and Kay Schwartz?
Oh, I don't like it.
So police started a tip hotline in hopes that someone would call in with some helpful information, and one call in particular sparked their interest. Someone who knew the family relayed that Bob, quote, steadfastly picketed an abortion clinic in Annapolis every Saturday for 4 years.
Oh, no.
And would approach women to get up in their faces as they entered the clinic and tried to persuade them from going through with the procedure.
Oh, Bob, buddy.
He was so aggressive in his tactics that a few of the women he interacted with actually ended up filing police reports against him.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And they went down that list of women and contacted all of them, but didn't come up with any solid leads.
Wow.
Yep. So they also looked at Kay's teaching career to see if she could have angered a student, but by all accounts, she was an extremely laid-back teacher who rarely disciplined her students and was really well-liked by everyone. So aside from Bob's work at the abortion clinic, which led nowhere, police were unable to establish any other reason that anyone would have wanted to kill either Bob or Kay Schwartz. So a week after the couple was murdered, police didn't have any solid leads, and so decided to start all over again from the beginning and see if there was anything that they had missed. They re-listened to Larry's 911 call and noticed something they'd initially missed, which was that he reported to the operator that he thought his parents were dead.
Oh, no.
When they compared that to the report taken by officers on the scene, they realized that he had told the responding officer that he hadn't gone downstairs yet, so wouldn't have had any knowledge of his father's well-being, as he was behind closed doors in the basement office.
Okay, I mean, it's not looking good for Larry, but I also might assume if my dad wasn't helping me and I could see that my mom was dead, my dad was dead.
Yes. I would also, yes. But that inconsistency led them to relook at all of Larry's reports from that day, and there were several more inconsistencies in his story.
Buddy.
For example, Larry had initially reported that he'd looked out the dining room window after Annie said she didn't know where their parents were, and that's when he saw Kay's body in the yard. Detectives looked out that same window and weren't able to see her body from that vantage point. So they wondered if maybe he'd been confused and meant the kitchen window, but the view of the area was even worse from that window. So one detective climbed on the kitchen counter and still couldn't begin to see the place where Kay's body had been. So detectives were puzzled as to how he would have discovered her body without getting closer to where she had been killed, because he hadn't been where he'd said he'd been when he discovered that she was dead.
Right.
Naturally, police wanted to talk to Larry to clear up the inconsistencies, but at that point, he'd gotten an attorney, and the attorney had advised him not to talk to the authorities.
He's this similar age, like 17, 16?
17, yep.
Yeah.
But he's this, yeah, he was very sweet, mild-mannered, shy, right. Super cute. Luckily for police, the results of the bloody palm print came back from the lab and confirmed that it was indeed one of the Schwartz's children who had put it there, but it wasn't their first suspect, Michael. It was their first adopted son, Larry.
Larry. I thought for a minute you're going to be like, it was Annie. And I was like,
oh, I know, that would be fucking creepy. No, sweet Annie had nothing to do with this.
Oh, I hate it.
At that point, an arrest warrant was issued and Larry was taken into custody. He was charged as an adult with 2 counts of first-degree murder, and everyone who knew the family was floored by the fact that easygoing, likable Larry was the one responsible for his parents' murders. So Larry's defense team advised him to continue to maintain his silence, so police were left on their own to build a case, which they did over the next 15 months. Detectives spoke to countless people who knew the members of the Schwartz family, and it became apparent that both Michael and Larry were under a lot of pressure to perform, were treated harshly when they didn't. Both boys struggled in school, and Bob was very hard on them as a result. It also seems like Larry was regularly restricted from leaving their property and was overprotected and sheltered in a way that wasn't healthy for his development. People also speculated that Michael was a continued bad influence on Larry and that he'd been in contact with his brother, who changed his perspective on their parents. Mm-hmm. Michael repeatedly spoke to Larry about the fact that Bob and Kay had abandoned him. And of course, Larry also lived in fear that his parents would do the same thing to him if he didn't perform.
That's awful.
Awful. So much stress. After 15 months of building the case, trial was set to start when something completely unexpected happened. At the 11th hour, Larry broke down, sobbing, and confessed to his attorneys that he had, in fact, been the one that killed both of his parents.
Oh, Larry.
Larry pled guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to two consecutive 20-year sentences for the murders. So, at the same time.
Thank you.
And I think that there was something about a 12-year suspended sentence. So it was a very short sentence, okay. Essentially. This woman, I watched a video of a woman, I think, that wrote a book about it. And she's like, I honestly have never seen a more lenient sentencing.
Yeah, that's,
you know, for two cold-blooded murders. Yeah. The detective who'd primarily worked the case was given the opportunity to ask Larry why he'd committed the murders. And he said, quote, I just snapped. He explained that he'd gotten home from school that afternoon and he had failed a Spanish test, which his mother had asked him about. She had been putting a lot of pressure on him to study harder, to do better in his studies. And so as she asked him how he'd done, she made some sort of a comment about how she was sure he had failed.
Oh, no.
And it sent Larry into a rage.
Oy.
He then took a knife and started stabbing her in the neck. And when he realized Bob heard what was going on, he attacked him as well. Larry didn't mention chasing Kay through the neighborhood, but it was revealed that she had been stabbed in the esophagus, and so detectives concluded that she might not have been able to scream for help.
Oh, no. And Larry... can we just touch on this nude thing? Like, I can't imagine she was nude.
So I left that out, but I got a lot of this information. It's not because it was 1984, you know, it's one of those cases that's kind of hard to find articles about. So I watched a video on most of it, interviews with the families and the detectives and everything. And they left that part out, but I did read a research paper that said that it was like, quote unquote, like one final humiliation that Larry removed her clothes.
Okay.
So I don't know, but I did see multiple times that she was found nude. So.
Okay. Well, I'm just picturing her like having this conversation about the Spanish test while she's naked. And
yeah, good
so
point.
I couldn't get past it. That would make more sense that he was angry and
I think that
do
was
terrible
what
things
happened.
To her. Okay.
Yes. That's what I think happened. Okay. So I just kind of left it out because I couldn't really confirm that detail, but I am 80 to 90% sure she was found nude.
Okay.
So Larry was able to track her down after she escaped, finish his attack, which he admitted to doing with the axe. So Annie was adopted by another family and Michael ended up homeless, drug addicted and living on the streets. Michael and his friends decided to rob a man of a jar of quarters he kept in his bedroom.
No, Michael.
And while they were in the process of the robbery, they stabbed the man to death.
Damn it.
I know. Michael was sentenced to life in prison for the murder and remains there to this day.
I hate it.
Larry was released in 1993 at age 27 and went on to attend college and start a family of his own. Before he died unexpectedly of a heart attack at 39.
Larry.
I know.
It's
a fuck. I think it was his defense attorney that was like, it's just the most lose case ever. It's like everybody fucking lost in this case. Like nobody.
I hate it.
Came out on top. So the reason I did this episode, I did a an episode recently on Patreon, and I made a comment about how adoption isn't always the answer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really want to tread lightly here, you know, because it's not an experience that I have had. I was not adopted. Mm-hmm. I have not adopted someone. And so I think that there are a good trillion cases of successful adoptions, and I'm not, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not an expert. But right after I made that comment, and, you know, I'm thinking a lot about adoption right now because of Roe v. Wade, and mm-hmm. everyone's like, well, you could just put the kid up for adoption. Well, it's not always the answer. Right. So right after I said that, I saw a video explaining that of the 500 estimated serial killers in United States history, 16% were adopted as children.
Wow.
And adoptees represent only 2 or 3% of the general population. Wow. So adoptees are 15 times more likely to kill one or both of their adoptive parents than biological children. And this is a topic that is being more widely studied as adopted people speak out about their experiences and the deep trauma that comes with the experience. And, you know, I think that you can have, you know, I think people have successful adoptions, right? Sure. I think that there are adopted people who are happy and well-adjusted, but I think it's because their families that adopted them helped them through the trauma of being adopted,
right?
So I think that's the big thing to keep in mind. Whereas a lot of people have entered into adoptive families who want to just suppress the trauma mm-hmm. of being adopted. And that's
I think especially, I don't know what it is like now, but I think when we were growing up, it was, you should be grateful we saved
exactly.
you.
Exactly. Exactly. Right.
You're better off than you would have been.
Yes. So. And adopted parents were looked at as just like saviors on high, right? Yes. Like, oh my God, you're such good people to take in a child that's not mm-hmm. yours. And like the message of, you know, kids.
You weren't wanted and
that.
I wanted. Yeah. I was kind enough to take you in.
Yeah. Well, it's a child who had no mm-hmm. choice. Mm-hmm. So there is a controversial syndrome called adopted child syndrome, quote, that has been used to explain behaviors in adopted children that are claimed to be related to their adoptive status. Specifically, these include problems in bonding, attachment disorders, lying, stealing, defiance of authority, and acts of violence. So I found a great paper by an adoption specialist named Tracy Carlos, who has consulted on several cases where an adoptee murdered their adoptive parents. And she wrote, quote, as an adoptee and adoption specialist, I understand that during childhood and adulthood, all adoptees are at a higher risk for psychological maladjustment. Mm-hmm. A child cannot be separated from their birth mother without repercussions. Adoptees struggle with genealogical bewilderment, in parentheses, the experience of not growing up with one's biological parents, not knowing any blood relatives, and losing the protection that genealogical continuity provides. Mm-hmm. Most adoptees, to one degree or another, suffer from abandonment and rejection issues. But for some, the unresolved pain stemming from being adopted, coupled with the secrecy inherent in adoption, mm-hmm. creates a perfect storm in which the adoptee reacts to the traumatic effects of the adoption with identified antisocial behaviors. Mm-hmm. She goes on to say, quote, most of the parricide cases that I have been involved in have been committed by young teenage adoptees that murder their entire family in one act of cataclysmic rage, mm-hmm. a crime of passion.
Yep.
There are striking similarities in these cases. They have been raised in middle-class families, adopted at birth in a closed adoption. They have no previous criminal history or convictions, and they did not leave the scene of the crime, but rather are the ones who call for help. Mm-hmm. The question asked of me is why? What went wrong? And she argues, quote, adoptees need to have, should have, the same civil rights as non-adopted people. We are one of the few remaining groups that are not legally entitled to know our history's roots or heritage, whose records are sealed from us permanently and forever. We are perpetually viewed as children who are not entitled to our most basic personal knowledge and truth. My hope is that the movement in Connecticut, she was writing obviously about a specific case in Connecticut, to open adoption records will pass and that other states will gather in the momentum and give adopted people the rights that are afforded all human beings. I believe that it behooves us as a society to see the dangers that closed adoption records create for the adoptee, their family, and the world at large.
Yes. Heck yes.
So there you go, guys.
Oh, man. That's a lot to chew on.
Wildly complicated case
Oh, yeah.
of the murder of Bob and Kay Schwartz. works. So yeah, Sadie's therapist said a great thing once, which is, it's not the trauma. Everyone's going to suffer trauma. Everyone's going to experience things that are really hard and, you know, change you forever. And it's not the act itself, the event itself. It's how you were supported through the event. Mm-hmm. So we can do this right. We just are currently not doing it very well. I think it's becoming more apparent that there are plenty of good adaptions, but there are just as many people who are really struggling and really suffering, and that's unnecessary. So
I'm curious for our listeners, you know, those who've been adopted or have adopted children.
Yeah.
You know, tell us about it, because it really is not, we're not experts, and I would love to hear people's experiences and, you know, the challenges and the highlights and what worked and what didn't. And, you know, to have that conversation, I'd be very interested in hearing more about it.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, obviously people who adopt children do not deserve to die.
Like, no.
Be real clear about that too, you know, but I can't understand, you know, these children have complicated, you know, deep trauma, 6 years of their life spent, you know, experiencing physical abuse, who knows, you know,
those little years are just, you know, thinking about my kids, like, it's everything. I really believe it. You know, it's just so important. Those first handful of years.
Well, and even the main detective on that case, he said, you know, he's like, I understand Larry. He's like, I understand it. He's like, what he did was not right. It's not justifiable. He's like, but I think, and obviously I think the judge, you know, had sympathy for him and understood that he wasn't a bad kid. He really could not control. You just can't put a kid in that circumstance and then push and push and push and push, you know. Even the case, like the family that I covered, I think on Patreon, about the family band, you know, the very deeply religious, the wife swap murders. Deeply religious family who just like turned the clamps down on their kids for all these years. And, you know,
it's just not good.
No. So there you go, guys.
There you go. Wow, Court.
Yep.
Terrible story. Very interesting story.
I super thought so too.
Interested into that, learning more.
Yeah.
Oy, boy. Well, thanks. Thank you for that.
You're welcome. And we don't have name times to soften the fucking fucky.
I can tell you about raccoons in the wall.
Just tell the people about the raccoons in the wall.
Okay, so we've covered the fact that Courtney and I's sweet grandma Wilma Eck is in her last days presently, and is at home on hospice care, and, you know, as far as the dying process goes, is doing well. I have been taking turns with my you okay?
Yep, just punching mics.
I've been taking turns with my aunt and my mother, helping care for her around the clock, right? She needs it. The first night that I was there, I heard raccoons, and I thought they were outside, and it was sort of nice at the time. I was like, oh, that's nice, you know. Here I am with grandma, and oh, there's raccoons. And my aunt was also there the first night, and we realized that they were inside the house, and we were trying to figure out where it was, and we couldn't really figure it out. So the next night, I'm walking down the hallway, and the raccoon is chittering right next to my head in the wall. And I am processing. I mean, it's the middle of the night. I'm processing my grandmother's death. You know, she's going through the motions, agitated. And then there are raccoons in the wall. Turns out that there is a family of raccoons, and there are babies, and they're in the attic, and they do get into the wall somehow, but we can't take them out until the babies are old enough, or they will die in there without their parents. Like, we could trap the parents. So they're going to just hang out in the walls for a while. But the other night, I was finding them really comforting. Like, they're playing, and you can hear them like rolling around and like, what the heck, you guys? I mean, really?
Well, and I, of course, am like, I have seen that horror movie. Yes. I have seen the dementia, like, Taking of Deborah Logan or whatever it's called, Relic. Like, I have seen this horror movie and I was like, yeah, dad's going to go into the attic to place the traps to catch the raccoons and find a portal into another dimension and be like, well, the darndest thing just happened. I just saw my past self and my future self all at once. Right. And
yeah, or it's not going to be raccoons. It's just going to be in my mind, you know, like,
right. Exactly.
Yeah,
it's
going to get real weird real quick. Yes. And thank goodness, like, our grandmother is very hard of hearing. And couldn't ever, I mean, who knows how long the raccoons have been in our house and we just didn't hear them because we didn't spend the night there.
Right.
Right. But thank God she can't hear them, because that would just make her feel legitimately crazy. Right.
Legitimately crazy.
And she's not, I mean, she doesn't have dementia. She, you know, she's just old. But like, God, thank God she didn't know that there were raccoons in her walls.
And it just, like, I just feel like everything right now too is so heightened. It's just like everything that's happening is happening plus, right? Right. So it's one thing to like support your grandmother's passing. It's another thing to support your grandmother's passing with a family of raccoons in the fucking walls.
Where you're trying to get as much rest as you can, but you also need to keep your ears open in case she needs you, but then you don't know if it's her or the raccoons making a noise, right? It's just very interesting. But I'm finding myself attached, and I've told my dad he has to keep the babies alive. Like, we gotta get the family moved out and then we can patch the hole. But
yeah. But Laura said that she had a family of raccoons in our ceiling before we met, and the babies followed the mom right on into the trap. They put the peanut butter in there and the babies will just follow. They'll just all end up in the trap, no problem. Yeah,
we could try that, but I don't know. I just, you know, maybe they'll be grown soon. And honestly, I'm just gonna miss them when they're not in the walls anymore.
And he's like, it's fine.
You know, and dad's like, well, they could completely destroy the electrical wires. Who needs lights?
Yeah, fine. I was gonna say, they're gonna eat, you're gonna shred your drywall and eat your electrical wires. But Sadie's like, but the babies.
But wait, I need to hear them get bigger.
Well, it's like my koi. I have a koi living in my bathtub because my friend wanted a koi fish, and I bought her one for her 40th birthday. She had this incredible koi pond. She bought a house and it came with this koi pond, and long story short, somebody else bought her a koi too for her 40th birthday. They just plunked that koi right on into the pond, which is not something you're supposed to do, and that koi killed most of her koi. So in the meantime, my koi shows up and we can't put my koi in that pond with the remaining fish because they're traumatized and also have koi herpes. And so I turned my bathtub into a koi pond, and I have koi living in my koi pond bathtub, and I love him. I'm very attached to him.
I was going
to
say, are you going to give him back? Are you going
to
give
him back? Well, so she, you know, we're constantly trying to figure out, they're going to build another koi pond, but, you know, we're coming up on the winter, and so they're going to spend all this money to make this pond to put the fish in it to go night-night for the winter, right? Mm-hmm. And so they were like, we're going to get the other fish a blood test and then get this fish a blood test. And then if they are compatible, you know, because my fish should have a herpes vaccine. But these fish were so old. These are like 20-year-old koi that they were probably introduced into that pond before they vaccinated koi for herpes, is what the vet said. So I know. And so I was like, I don't know. He's kind of a scaredy fish. I just started like defending why we shouldn't put my little fish in with her fish. I don't know. I'm like,
I think he should just keep the fish and get her another koi.
Well, but the problem is koi get too big. He's already technically too big for my bathtub. Koi need 220 gallons of water per fish, basically. Yeah.
Well,
so,
I mean, at least you could go visit.
I want him in that pond, like, ultimately. But now I'm like making decisions for the well-being of this koi fish and
so cute.
Endowing him with all these different human traits.
Just put him in the wall with the raccoons.
I was gonna say, I mean, the reason we didn't build a koi pond, because I seriously was like ready to throw down $6,000 or something for
Laura's
a fucking koi pond.
No.
Well, but the reason we didn't do it is because it would just be a raccoon snack factory, right?
Yeah.
They would just get snatched right
out.
But
what if they were raised together, like the babies in the wall and the baby koi?
That's a good idea.
They're best friends.
Yep. Swimming around. I know our other friends have a koi pond, an empty koi pond. And I was like, can we put him in there? And she's like, I literally woke up like last week and there were three baby raccoons bathing in my koi pond.
I'm picturing in my mind, we tear out the drywall, we put in plexiglass. I get my, and then we put a hamster tube full of water for the koi, and then the baby raccoons can play and the koi can swim through the tubes, and done.
I'm into it. I mean, I'm so attached to this fish. They're like swimming puppies. They're so cool. I don't know. Now that I know how cool koi are, I'm like, I really want a koi, but I can't have one. Oh my God. But I taught him how to eat out of my hand immediately. Oh. He comes swimming up every time I go to the bathroom. He's like, give me my snack.
Right. Time for wall aquarium squirt.
I guess. I think you're a genius. Oh my God.
Oh Lord. Should we do some quick shouty outies?
Yeah, let's do. My stomach is actively growling. Yeah. But yes, let's do two. I get two in me.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, we have to do three. I'm sorry.
Yeah, let's do three.
Okay. Thank you so much to Melissa H.
Melissa, high five. High five. High five. You get a high five for all that you're doing, and everybody knows that you are on the moving because you're Melissa and you are the best one all over town. They are saying you're the best one because you're Melissa and you deserve a high five.
Yes. Thank you so much to Jackie E.
Oh my God. I love the name Jackie.
Jackie Eck. Pretty sure.
Probably Jackie Eck, not Jackie E. Nassus. Jackie.
What if it was?
Yeah, Jackie E. Nassus. Jackie E4. Excellent. Jackie E-commerce, because she's got it all. Jackie E-excitement. Jackie E-lation. Jackie Elevation, take it to the next level. Jackie can do it every time.
Thank you so much. And this is last but not certainly not least.
Yeah.
Thank you so much to Ravine Lemon.
This is the sound of me dying of it. Oh, Ravine Lemon. Oh. We didn't have name time this week, and that's why, because we needed to reserve the entire name time.
I know.
Ravine Lemon?
Yes.
Oh my God. Fucking winner. Put that right up on the pedestal with Cindy Pancake. Put it up there, Ravine Lemon. There's nothing to say about that because I can't. You've stolen my breath. You've stolen my heart.
Right, I picture like our podcast going dark right now, and then I come on. I'm here to tell you that the name Ravine Lemon killed Courtney from happiness.
Exactly, so this is the end of show. We will kill in memoriam. Courtney Act died of the name Ravine Lemon. God, well done. Jeez, damn it,
man. Hey, thanks everyone so much for listening. Cannot say it enough. You are the best. You win all the prizes.
Smell good.
Yes.
You're intelligent. You're brave.
Yes.
And if you want to spend more time with us, you can go to our social media, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook,
TikTok,
which is Instagram. Where we spend all of our time now. Instagram at They Will Kill, and go to our website, theywillkill.com. You can email us at gmail.com. theywillkillpodcast@gmail.com.
Just try it. See what happens.
Open up Gmail, compose,
give it a go.
It's fine.
Yep. Rate, review, subscribe, please.
Yes, please.
And we always want to thank AJ Bergantz, Bergantz, for our music.
Thank you so much, AJ.
What if I started spelling his name every time? A as in F, alligator. J as in jumping.
Alpha. Zebra. Z. That's what they say in New Zealand. Z.
Yeah. We got to go. My kids are home. And remember,
does anybody else get fucking like weirdly triggered by those Everly Well commercials?
I don't ever watch commercials, so.
Well, I feel like it pops up a lot on Hulu. I don't know where they mostly advertise, but I'm like, I would actually like to do Everly Well. I would like to know what my food allergies are, but they pick the least relatable, most like dislikable. Yes,
I have seen those.
Specifically women. And he's like, I really want to drink oat milk, but I also really want to eat fresh almonds. And it's just really hard on my tum-tum. And you're like, oh!
I heard that. I could be totally wrong, but are allergy tests mostly a scam anyway? No?
Probably. I would, like, you know, I want to know if I shouldn't be eating, you know,
sure,
oat milk or whatever. I don't eat oat milk, but, you know.
Pomegranates.
Yeah. Like, what is it? What is best for me? But then they're just like, with their, like, weird condescending faces and their, what's that brand that's like, like, liberal, like, semi-wealthy women wear, starts with an E also. It's like sustainable fabrics and stuff.
Eloquii or something.
Oh, what's it called? Damn it. So you're all screaming it right now. Everybody wears it. I mean, like, hip girls wear, a lot of our friends wear it, but it's like, that's what these women are wearing, mm-hmm. You know? And it's all like, I can't wear it because I just look like a PE, like a teacher, you know, and in a good way, like the bad version of a teacher, you know, but that, like, a beautiful girl on an Everly Well commercial can wear it and she just looks casual and effortless. And I was like, ugh. And it's called Everly Well.
So wait, what's the point? Don't do that. Don't watch
I don't
those.
Know. I just want to know if other people are as triggered by those, specifically by those commercials, as I am.
Tell us about it, guys.
I can't do it. But I can do you. Yes. And I love you.
We love you
in
so
a consensual
much.
Way. And we'll see you real soon.
Oh, Lord. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
We love you. Goodbye.
'm journalist Carolyn Osorio, and I invite you to join me and my co-host, Brandon Morgan, on our podcast, Criminal Mischief. From law enforcement officers seeking justice to victims' families seeking answers, every week there's a new case and a new victim whose story deserves to be told. New episodes of Criminal Mischief drop every Tuesday.